Summit on Blockchains, the Current State and Roadmap. My name's Cale Teeter. I'm part of Microsoft and the DX and TED organization, and I work specifically with ISVs and partners to onboard them into Azure and get them their products working the best on our platform. But I also work specifically in blockchain with our engineering group. So let's start with what we have here. The first thing is we do have a hashtag set up here. It's hashtag Microsoft JWS. So if you have any questions as we go through the session today, feel free to throw them out there, and we'll get to them as fast as we can, and we'll move forward here. So this session is really around blockchains, and I labeled it Current State and Roadmap because basically what I want to do is try to take you through how we got started here and what's going forward. So we basically had blockchain technology. It's been around for quite some time now. Now it's starting to gain some footprint with the enterprise market. And how did that kind of evolve, as well as what is Microsoft doing in the space, and how are we adding value in this area? So the first thing is to kind of understand what is a blockchain, and what are the core principles that need to be understood when you start working in the blockchain space. What are the things that's going to drive you to say, actually, I need to use this technology? This is not a technology to solve every problem, but it is a really key technology to solve a specific set of problems that we have here. So the things to understand here is what's on the screen. I'll walk through each one of these. One of the core fundamentals is the security aspect. So especially in today's world where everything's connected, there's a very high focus on how secure we can make systems. The blockchain technology has a core principle grounded in some cryptography that's been proven over many years. So this cryptography is going to be used to create transactions, and this is one of the principles that's going to allow us to say that these things are impervious to fraud and can allow us to do these trustless environments. And we'll talk through what does that mean. But essentially, we can say with mathematical certainty based on some cryptography primitives that we have something here that's sound from a security standpoint. The next aspect is on the shared aspect. So this is really unique to the blockchain, and this is one of the core things that this thing brings to the table to help solve business problems. So when you have multiple organizations who actually want to work together, and they don't necessarily trust each other, and I don't mean that from a way of saying I really just don't trust that guy. They just say, hey, we're two different organizations, and we have different security protocols, and we do things slightly differently. How do we maintain some sort of communication between ourselves and share data in such a way that we can do it seamlessly, but also maintain our sanity and our security policies that we have? So the shared aspect really brings this to the table to say, in a normal world today, we would have two businesses that want to communicate. Business one and business two, they each have a database of this application they're going to work together on, and they're going to commit a transaction in one side. The other company is then going to say, okay, I accept that transaction you sent, and then they will commit it as well. So there's kind of a disconnected synchronization that's happening there. But if you could say, what if we had one database in the middle that everybody shared? Well, everybody would like that. The problem is they don't necessarily, who would own it? How do you trust somebody to own that? We have two parties involved here. And so that's one of the things that blockchain and this distributed ledger technology kind of solves. We have a logical distributed ledger that these companies can feed into from a write and read perspective. The distributed nature, so these blockchains focus on a technology that allows us to basically not have a central source where this data is being held. In that way, we all have replicas of the blockchain, the blocks that are on the blockchain, and this way we can basically maintain our sync with it and be able to say, hey, that doesn't jive with what I saw last. So as we're doing this, we're not just pointing back to one server that could be a central point of an attack. A ledger perspective, again, think of an accounting system or a transaction log in a database. This is a write once, immutable record. Again, so think of it like just like accounting. So when we add records to this, as we commit things to the blockchain, we can't go back and modify that record. This is one of the core principles to say we can trust this network now because we know that somebody can't come in and modify this data. And it's mathematically built that way to do that. So there is no way around this system. It's not built around a program even per se. It's built around some security technology to make it impossible to change those records. So that's a really unique aspect. So we can write once and read many. Now, that helps us decentralize data in a trustless environment. I mentioned trustless just a minute ago, and what does that mean? That basically means in a normal world, on the left side here, we have a traditional system where everybody's feeding into one central point. That becomes something that people might try to attack or compromise or whatnot. A blockchain system is really built around, no, everybody has a copy of that database, essentially. And we work around what's called a consensus to basically build a consensus between us to say, well, we want to change the system. Kind of everybody has to agree to that, or a majority has to agree to that. And in that way, we can basically maintain that one person or bad actor can't actually take over the system and start manipulating it in ways that might be nefarious. So a decentralized system has a lot of great benefits here. We eliminate the intermediaries between, so this synchronization, or in many cases, if it's a financial transaction, we have other parties that are actually involved in the middle to make sure fraud is not happening. For one business case. So that's something to think about. This is able to make the system simpler, and we can eliminate those intermediaries in between. This also reduces fraud because two things are happening here. We have a highly secure network because we're using strong cryptography primitives, but it's also transparent. So as people are making changes to this, it's not being hidden from everybody. The blockchains, if you go to like a public blockchain like Ethereum or Bitcoin, when you establish connections to those networks, you can see all the everything that's happening out there with those transactions. Everybody can see all the transactions that are happening. You can see all the history that's happened out there. This increases the speed and efficiency. Now, this is a little bit slightly misleading, right? So it's going to increase efficiency because we can basically have one central database to maintain all this data, and we don't have to do all this synchronization and reconciliation. On the same token, this does take time. That's one thing to understand about these systems. As a transaction is committed, it's not just in one server. It's actually happening on a bunch of servers out there. Depending on how big the network is, it could be thousands or tens of thousands of servers. And so in that model, we actually do see some, slowness there, actually, as the transactions are committed. But it's at the benefit of saying, hey, we know that transaction's sound and hasn't been tampered with. There's a lot of work and technology going into that, and we're also leading some charges there, and we'll talk about that later with cryptlets around how can we increase the efficiency and the speed of the transactions to happen so we can have both strong security and speed. This increases revenue and savings for these companies. Obviously, when we reduce complexity with enterprises, it's a good thing. Makes it easy for people to maintain these. And the other thing is it kind of removes the need for you to be so focused on the edge network and the perimeters of these things. Right now, when you think about this, when you're saving data to a database or talking across the internet, there's a high amount of scrutiny and focus on how do we secure those endpoints, make sure it's HTTPS, and all these different security technologies around that. But the closer you can get when we write the transaction to the client, so if I'm sitting at the client and I could sign a transaction on my machine before it even goes out there on the internet, that's a good thing because basically we've got encryption the whole way through the system then at that point. And that makes this really strong because then if somebody messes up a firewall rule or something like that on the internet, we still have encrypted data flowing there. We don't have to focus as much on the edge and the perimeter of this. From an industry disruption standpoint, this actually disrupts a lot of different industries. This isn't something that's just focused on finance. Finance is a big one because obviously when you start talking about ledgers, this naturally draws people into that mindset and thinking about how could we do, trading systems and asset systems and all these different things that happen in a financial industry. This thing fits like a glove in that space. But it also fits in other spaces like retail, so supply chain management. How can we establish provenance or the origin of a guaranteed origin of pieces of a component in a device or an actual product or these kind of things in that system? That's a really good thing. And also, obviously, on the payment side, it fits pretty well there. On the healthcare side, we're thinking about, records, patient records. How can we establish sort of self-sovereign identities? There's a lot of work that's being going on there. If you look at what Uport and some of these other people out there in the world are working on, some of these partners, they're looking to say, how can we establish these actual identities for these users out there in such a way that you can hold the actual keys, the private keys to these things? That's a really good thing because it puts the power back in the user's hands. Now we don't have that centralized database that's vulnerable so much to the attack that we see today on the internet. And then from a government standpoint, increasing transparency and being able to track how things are happening here. Again, using it as something to track provenance or even different like asset registrations like the DMV or, you know, different things that happen, titles for houses, these different things. We see that actually be an impact there. And there's many more use cases. The media industry is looking at this as well. So this is highly disruptive, and I think a lot of people are really looking at this technology to say, how can we benefit from some of the things it provides us? So how does this work? We'll talk through a little bit about how this works from a high level. Maybe some of you are aware of this, but there is technology out there with private and public key pairs. This technology exists pretty prevalently on the internet if you're using SSL, HTTPS. Those certificates actually have keys associated with them. If you've used PGP keys in the past, similar technology, right? These are using very similar technologies. The difference here, and that we'll show, is how the ledger kind of fits into that and facilitates kind of the keys and how they work together to actually build a useful solution. So if we took a look at this, we could say, well, how does these keys work? So basically, we generate keys on the client side here. So we have an actor here on the left side, and we could feed data into there and basically run a mathematical function or a hash function on top of that. And basically what we're going to create is a digest out of that. Now let's create it in such a way that we can share that digest or the public aspect of that thing out there freely on the internet. And the private key, so there's a key pair here, the private key is still held with that owner on the left side, and that's not shared, that's private. The idea is that we can share something out there and we can use the private key to validate that thing. And from a really high level, that's really what this is about, is how do we make sure that we use a key pair to sign some data and be able to prove, and we're the only one that can prove it because we have these keys with this proven technology to do that. Now, this doesn't have to be a user. It could actually be a device as well. We mentioned maybe in the supply chain side, we have devices. In this case, we have a HoloLens here, but we typically have things that identify them, like a manufacturer's public key and a serial number and all these things that make them unique. We run those through the cryptographic hash function, and we could generate a digest out of that. Now, once we have that, that public key can be shared out there on a medium such as a blockchain, and we can use that then to basically establish, let's say, provenance of this device to say, hey, I can guarantee what the serial number, where this thing came from, all the metadata about that thing that's been coded into that hash, we can prove that, and I can prove I own that thing because I have the private key associated with it. And so when someone wants to validate it, obviously we use the private key to validate and say, here's the public information, and someone could issue a challenge and say, do you have the private key for this? Can you sign this data? And we can compare that in some cases, and we can actually compare and see that they do match and we have the private key. Now, that concept, if you looked at that as a on the surface, it's great. You know, it can work for identities or single objects, these kind of things. What makes the blockchain kind of unique is if you said, well, what if we took a bunch of those things that we signed? So in this case, we have a bunch of components, in this case, bolts, and we create digests out of them. So now we have unique footprints or fingerprints for each one of those things that we just produced. But what if we took all those then, the digests, and then hashed those? And that built, in this case, a bolt probably doesn't make a phone, but it's making some end device here, right? So all those pieces together make up this digest down at the bottom here, this ZX48. That's really cool because now if any aspect of that thing were to change, it would break the hash. So we can guarantee every piece that actually went into that device because we know the digest that fed into that one-way hash. And again, from an ownership perspective, this is interesting from looking at saying, you know, I can anchor my identity there, I can anchor these objects there with these digests, but how is this valuable? So in this case, you can see now we've introduced our ledger here in the middle, and that would represent potentially a blockchain. And so a user has their private and public key pair, and we have a device here that has its own private and public key pair, and we can establish in the ledger that Kale bought this device in this case. So when you go to the store and you purchase a product in the future, the transfer of ownership could happen at that point, and that happens on the blockchain. So we could say, okay, let's go ahead and sign it, and now Kale has the ownership of this device on the blockchain. Now, nobody else can take that over because I am the one who owns the private keys for that. Now I own that device. I legitimately own it. If someone else comes along and I say, okay, I want to sell this device to you, well, I have to transfer ownership to them. So in that case, we would use something like, in the Ethereum case, a smart contract, potentially, to do that transfer of ownership. And what we'll do is basically we'll sign off on it, we'll have them sign it, and now the transfer of ownership gets triggered in the blockchain, and that user now is associated with that. And you can see the selling happens here, and now this user is associated with this device. Basically, it's a way for us to strongly control things that happen on this chain that we're talking about, this blockchain. Being able to establish the ownership of devices here, the relationship between things, whether they are users or real-world assets, and being able to do it from that aspect. And that's why things like Bitcoin and Ethereum, when you look at the public side of it, is focused around money. Those are really around like a digital currency. And really, what's that about? That's about, you know, trade and how much do I have of this particular thing, and it has some real-world value. So that's where this all comes back to. Now, from a high level in the blockchain, we've been talking about this chain, and we talked about some of the cryptography stuff that's happening here, but how does this actually work? So what happens is, on the left side here, you can see these are representing transactions that are coming in here and blocks. And essentially what happens is, we don't immediately, like if you want to put something on the blockchain, you want to execute a transaction, when you call the blockchain and say, I want to do this thing, it doesn't happen instantly. So there's a block size, there's all kinds of different things that go into when does a block actually get minted. So when we think about that, we basically pile up a bunch of stuff over here on the left side here. So we have some transactions building up, and then once they hit a high watermark to say, okay, now it's time for us to create a block, we're going to go ahead and hash those, and then we're going to write that block. And on the right side, you can see that at the bottom there, we wrote a block, and then we started writing subsequent blocks. Now the interesting aspect here is these things are tied through, and if you understand hash trees or Merkle trees, these things are actually tied through essentially a hash tree. So you say, okay, well, we've established the first block, and now the second bit of transactions came along, we need to do a new block. It's not isolated. It actually, when we hash the second set of transactions, we also then bring those in and tie them in with the first block, so we hash it to that. So now nothing can break this chain, hence the term blockchain. So as we're building this hash tree with this relationship between the blocks inside of there, they can't be broken mathematically. If somebody tried to go back in and change one of those transactions from one of the old blocks in there, the whole thing would be invalid, because even one bit would actually cause that to break. And that provides that really strong security that we get with this system in making sure that things are immutable and not being able to be changed. Now, That's interesting. That's from a high level, that's the way blockchains have worked up to this point. If you looked at something like Bitcoin or Ethereum, I mentioned before, like the public networks, there's a bunch of other things happening out there right now. But what happens, where did we evolve from here then? What could we do? So that's literally just like trade or these financial type transactions. Well, along came this technology from Vitalik Buterin with the Ethereum network called smart contracts. And so we'll talk through what is a smart contract. So we have the same technology that we used with blockchain before, but now if you think a little bit about this, what would happen if we were able to actually have this be sort of like a service to us, or actually be able to have code up there that could run? So in this case, we could say, okay, we coded up some business logic, and that's what's represented in the top left there. We feed that in through our hash function. Again, we're hashing everything, so we know who the owner is definitively, and we know that it hasn't been tampered with. So when we do that hash function, we write that to the blockchain, right? So now that thing exists out there on the blockchain. On the right side, you can see it over there in the blockchain as a block got created. It's out there now. Now, what's interesting about this is an actor could come along now and say, in this case, they're doing an altcoin transaction, but they could actually execute on top of that thing. And what do I mean by that? I mean, okay, you can actually, from your client, say, hey, I want to sign a transaction, so I want to call a function that's inside of this smart contract. But I'm not just going to call the function like a web service on the internet. I'm actually going to write that into a transaction locally on my machine, and I'm going to sign it with my keys. So now we have strong encryption, strong security at that point. We feed that through into the blockchain as a transaction. And what happens is, when it's time to write a block in this system, let's talk about Ethereum, the EVM would wake up and say, okay, this guy says he wants to execute this function in this smart contract that exists over here. There's a lot of different things that happen there with gas and ether, but we'll simplify it for now. We'll just say he's going to go ahead and execute that on your behalf. So you fed in your parameters that were signed and everything. We will basically go find that smart contract, the EVM will. It will feed your parameters into it. It will execute whatever needs to happen there. It will get the result, and it will send that back. From a very high level, this is what smart contracts are about, making this programmable. So now it's not just about transferring ownership or whether it's money or an object, but it's actually writing code. So we could, this smart contract language, there's a couple of them out there, but Solidity is one of the high-level languages that people use. It's kind of like JavaScript. So you can write these functions in a language that's relatively familiar to people, and you can basically have workflow and business logic that executes up there on your behalf in a very strong, cryptographically secure and distributed nature. So smart contracts are more than just a database or a shared truth. You know, the shared truth is the state that we were talking about before. So if I transfer ownership of an asset from one person to another, the state is actually being held up there in the blockchain. And that still exists with smart contracts. We can have state in the smart contracts themselves. We just have primitives defined inside of there that's going to hold the state. But we also can do these other things, like I said, the programmatic side of it. So you can think of 1.0, and I have a slide on this, you can think of 1.0 as kind of like where blockchains got started with Bitcoin and the early days of that where we could transfer ownership. Blockchain 2.0 is the state machine itself still, so we have everything from 1.0. We now have code as well, so now we can, it's programmable for us to do things with it. Now, I labeled this one chains, and more chains. So as this stuff kind of evolved, this technology, we have different kind of, we'll call them database types. We have public, private, permission, consortium. We could talk through each one of these. But in a public side, you think about it as really trustless. Because in a public setting, basically, we're building a blockchain or we're building a whole series of nodes out there on the internet that are going to do something for us. But we definitely do not trust everybody on the internet because we don't know who they are or what they're doing. So in that way, we have to have things, and if you look at the bottom of this slide under consensus, we have different proofs or consensus algorithms that work with us to make sure that these systems work well. In a trustless system, a truly trustless system, the one that's very popular right now is proof of work, which is a mining operation. And I'll take a second to describe what that means. So from a mining perspective, what's happening here, we talked through, hey, everybody's going to write transactions. So in the public side, let's say Bitcoin, when people are doing this, they're going to write their transactions up there. Eventually, something's going to happen, right? Somebody has to process this transaction, these nodes. Not everybody that's connected to the network using it have to actually process the transactions or be a miner, for instance. They could actually simply be executing transactions, just like a user on the internet. But the miners themselves need to be incentivized, right? Because we don't, this is a decentralized type organization. There's no like one central authority that's saying, we're going to stand up all the servers to run this thing, because then that potentially could be compromised because it would be one organization. So you have all these people from the internet submitting their compute power, essentially, to say, yeah, I'll be part of this, but how are you incentivizing me? With mining, you're basically saying, I'm going to give you a really hard problem to solve. And whoever can solve it first in this whole network of machines, I'm going to give you some real-world value out of this, and you can be the one who writes the block. And so these the function that you give them, or this math, or this hard problem to solve, is a hash function, but you basically give them something that's going to take a tremendous amount of compute to figure out. And this is dynamic, right? So we can kind of scale this as we see more miners come, as the networks change, so it's a pretty complex system. But essentially what happens is they'll be given a function that says it's really hard to solve, it's really hard to get the answer, but it's really easy to verify that somebody got the right answer. So in this way, we can run this and have these guys go crank away and try to solve the problem. Somebody's going to come through first and say, I have the answer, and then everybody validates it. So that, remember, that's an easy operation. Everybody can quickly validate it. Yep, this guy got the answer. Okay, he's the one who gets to write this block, and he gets an incentive. In the Bitcoin network, it's bitcoins, and then that translates into, you know, fiat currency if someone chose to pull it out of the digital cryptography or crypto world. Now, from a private side, that's interesting, but from a private side, businesses are looking at this to say, no, I just want to have like multiple business partners actually working together and sharing some data, right, in this system. And that's where Ethereum really shines. Ethereum has a public network too, but this is where Ethereum shines on the private side. There's other ones multi-chain. There's a bunch more listed. And if you go look on the internet, you'll see these things are popping up every day. These have some trust, right? Because they're not just, we just don't let anybody onto these chains. We actually control who has access to these networks. And so we call them consortium networks, where it's kind of a mix of private and potentially even permission blockchains. If you look at what zero knowledge proofs and SNARKs and those kind of things are doing, they can actually permission down to the column level. But from a consortium based standpoint, we're basically saying we have multiple parties and we're controlling who has access to that network. There's other consensus algorithms that are being worked on and researched right now. Proof of stake is a big one, which is more around escrow. So the proof of work is really cool, but it requires a tremendous amount of carbon footprint, a lot of electricity to do that. And it really doesn't make sense in a private setting with enterprises to say, hey, we have to have these massive machines to do this and compete to see who's going to rate the transaction. That works really well in trustless environment, but in a semi-trusted model, it makes more sense to do something like an escrow type model, which is what works is going on there with proof of stake. So we don't have to burn so much electricity, but we can still maintain a consensus algorithm so such that one business couldn't, for instance, take over the entire network. There's other ones that are out there that are being worked on, proof of identity, vote burn. There's all kinds of different consensus algorithms and even more spinning up every day. Some of them are specialized to a particular vertical industry, and then some are more general. Now, what are some of the gaps? I mean, it sounds all good that we now have like this private or the consortium-based stuff, and we also have the public side. Yeah, sounds really good, but like, what's the issues here right now? So some of the things is how to work with the existing systems. These are complex systems. They use these really advanced cryptography algorithms. So they're a little bit of a learning curve there when people are starting to get started with these. People are used to a relational database and a web application. Those can work in conjunction with a blockchain, but they are slightly different technologies, and you have to understand, you know, basically the flow of how these things work, what's getting executed, and how it's getting executed. From an operations and management perspective, there's a lot of work going on there from a monitoring perspective to say, how do we monitor these systems? How do we make sure that they're healthy? How do we make sure that they're not being compromised? From a security aspect, what pieces do we need to have in place? A lot of work from partners as well as Microsoft in that area. Privacy, obviously being a big one, we'll talk through that in a couple slides here. The whole idea of identity and key management is a big thing. Keys, obviously, as we walk through this, you see keys are kind of at the heart of what's happening here. So a compromised private key is a really bad thing. So the idea is, how do we secure those keys in such a manner that that doesn't happen? Just having them as a file on a file system is not really that secure. If an OS is compromised or something like that happens, maybe a virus or something, they could get a hold of those keys, and that's a bad thing. So how do we make it such that we can use things like biometrics or actual hardware? And we're working on some of that stuff inside Microsoft as well about how do we use hardware. If you look at what the consensus guys with UPort are doing, they have the same thing using a secure enclave in these devices. And again, that's a hardware-based solution that allows those keys not to leave the hardware. So we don't have to worry so much about the operating system side of that or something being compromised at that level. And oh yeah, the tools really need to improve. So it's very much a nascent technology right now. I mean, it's building. I think it's evolved quite a bit very quickly, and it's a lot of open source products that are coming together, but it's making these things ready for the enterprise, really, is what it's about now. So we have technology that works. It's kind of been proven. It's actually been proven in some very large-scale public networks. How do we now take that and operationalize it and make it something that an enterprise can consume? That's the focus with the private and consortium-based. So again, back to our evolution diagram here. We started out with the simple state machine. We moved on to the 2.0, which was, you know, the smart contracts and being programmable on that side. And now we're looking at 3.0 and the future. So again, we're not losing anything. We're picking up everything we had in 2.0 with the smart contracts, but we're now bringing in some new ideas. There's a lot of, like I mentioned before, you know, things that kind of bubble up here as you start to say, how do we make these enterprise worthy, and how do we do some of the things that enterprises would need to do? There's some specific things around these blockchains that can be barriers to that, and we're trying to kind of break those walls down. One of them is, how do we do off-chain stuff? So when you hear this mentioned in on the internet or at any of these conferences and these kind of things, you'll hear there's a lot of focus right now on off-chain. And you say, well, why do we want to put anything off-chain? The ledger's really strong. It's great. Let's just put everything there. Yeah, that's not really a great idea because itself, it can't really hold a whole lot of data. You can think of it as a database, but it doesn't really hold a ton of data inside it. It's actually very small what it can hold. It's really good at holding transactions and pointers to things that have happened. It's less about, you know, storing big binary objects and all kinds of things directly inside the blockchain. On the same token, how do you make calls off the blockchain? So I have a case scenario we're going to watch through here right now where we actually do need to make a call off-chain. So in this case, we have a bank, a hedge fund, and an insurance company who are engaged in something here, and a transaction, and they have a smart contract that's actually deployed on a blockchain that orchestrates this transaction for them. So everything's set up the way we normally do, but the only thing is we got a little twist here. Now, every day we need to calculate a rate that's going to be injected as part of the state in that smart contract. And this is LIBOR times a percentage and then the difference based on the price of gold. So in this case, it's a kind of a real-world financial, but you can think of it in any case. We need to get some data from off-chain, some sort of, in this case, a rate, and we need to inject that into the blockchain so that these guys can function based on good data. Now, the problem is the blockchain couldn't do that because if you look here, these little notebooks are representing the ledgers or nodes in this network. You can think, what if multiple of them all went off-chain, like went out and called a web service to get some rate? Well, they're not going to do it at the exact same time. So they might get a slightly different answer, which means how are they going to build consensus? Like, how could they all say, yeah, this is what I got? Because they're going to build a consensus eventually. Everybody has to agree that the transaction is sound. So in that case, that doesn't really work. And so there's a hard enforcement there to not be allowed to do off-chain, to make calls off-chain. So what do we do? Today, we have basically the concept of what's called an oracle. So an oracle is basically something that lives off-chain, and he can make calls into the smart contract. Just like any other client executing transactions against the blockchain, he could in turn do that as well, and that could be set up as a scheduled job or something that just runs. And that will work. So he just submits a transaction, it comes in there. But what's the downside here? We have to trust that guy. What if somebody hacks our oracle? Then they're going to skew the rate, and then everybody's operating on bad data. So this is bad. We don't want to have a situation where someone can actually compromise something that's feeding into the core system. So the idea was, and this is something that the Microsoft team's been working on, this idea of what's called cripplets. These are manifested in a couple different ways, and Marley Gray had talked about this a bit at DevCon. If you go back and look at some of the presentations from the DevCon conference, he goes into quite a bit of detail around these, and we'll kind of touch through what he reviewed there. But basically, the idea is to be able to have this attestated host out here with a secure protocol. I'll walk through a little bit about how that thing's actually established, but know that we're doing it both from a conceptual level, like a logical level, but also at a hardware level. So we're working with some of the leaders and partners in the industry to build that into the hardware itself. This way, we can have a strong assurance that machine is doing what we need it to do. Everything that it's doing is being signed, and we know for sure that it hasn't been compromised, it hasn't been touched from the outside. Again, back to a hardware-based aspect. And we can establish this secure protocol and make this a trusted host that allows us to now do things. Now, a lot of times what we do with off-chain now, and going outside of this scenario a little bit, this was more of a, we need to feed a rate in there, but if you think about it, what could we do from a storage perspective? If we have a lot of data that we need to put on the blockchain, we could put that data somewhere else and encrypt it with our keys, and then we could store and anchor that thing in the blockchain. So we'd store a hash in the blockchain that's pointing to that record. Now, if anything changed about that record, we can validate it with the record that exists in the transaction in the blockchain, so we know for sure that nobody tampered with that data. So that's kind of interesting from a storage perspective and relatively easy to do. What about compute? That's a bit harder to do, right? Because now you're talking about how do I execute code that may be executed in an EVM before or a virtual machine inside the Ethereum network that say, how do we do that now off-chain? So here's how this kind of works. Essentially, from a smart contract perspective, over here on the right side, we have some state here. In this case, we have a UN here that's a trade amount. Now you'll notice this doesn't exist today. This is what we're working on, building this type of attribute that would complement these smart contracts. These things are then going to trigger things in the EVM to say, hey, I know how to talk to this other thing out here. So think of it kind of like a crypto delegate. If you think about in terms of programming, we have delegates, we can make calls and have something do something on our behalf. So in this case, we would say, oh, I know how to process this thing. I know that when I see one of these things that I need to process, I have some policies. Again, there's some of that built into the system, signature checking, obviously, and transaction signing. But we can also do a cripplet lookup, so we can say, hey, which one of these do I need to redirect myself to and have it go do my job for me, either storage or compute. And so this is kind of the trust envelope, or how this actually functions, or we manifest it inside the blockchain. So this would be like a utility type cripplet. So in this scenario, we have a smart contract. This is some code over here on the right side that would represent our smart contract on the blockchain node. And then we have something maybe running over in the cloud here that's a cripplet that's going to function with us. So the provisioning of that thing happens. And maybe what we do is at some point we have to update the trade amount. So we'll have the utility cripplet at that time actually go do that thing for us and update that value, just like we just saw in another example, and we get a value back in here. Maybe it's a rate or some sort of a trade amount, and then we can store that as state and start working with that inside the blockchain. That's one way to do things. The other one is around what's called a contract cripplet. Now in this case, we can actually say, hey, we want to offload some compute. So in this case, we would have our actual cloud out here, our cloud cripplet, and we would pass over what we wanted to execute. So in this way, it's actually kind of like an extension to the EVM and allowing us to execute some things off-chain. The idea being there's a lot of compute resource might be needed there, right? There's a tremendous amount of focus on these networks and being able to do this directly in the blockchain. When you think about something like Ethereum, there's a concept of gas I mentioned before. So I'll take a step back and explain why that's important in this type of scenario. What happens is when you execute your smart contract, you write a function, right? So you're writing a couple lines of code. Now, if you write a very simple function, when you pass that into the EVM, what's going to happen is he's going to say, I can't just execute this. You have to give me something to execute this ether in this case. It's some sort of token in order to prove that I want you to run this. So we can't have like just people arbitrarily executing tons of stuff and bringing the network down. So they would say, okay, so in order to run this, I'll calculate the complexity of what's going to happen here, like the opcodes of actually what's going to execute inside your function. I'm going to come up with this value, and that's my gas. Like, I'm going to need that in order to execute. And then I'll ask you for that, and you have to provide that as part of the call to say, I want to execute this thing. So you can imagine that if you start building really complex ones, that's going to be a problem, right? Because as you build really complex ones, the price is going to go up, and then it gets more expensive to execute these transactions. So what if we could offload, what if we had something that was really complex, but it really doesn't make sense on the blockchain? We have another system that can kind of handle that securely. That's the idea of these cripplets, to offload some of the compute there and be able to do those transactions and then feed that back into the blockchain. This way we still have the aspects of the blockchain that are important, but we can do these high compute type scenarios. So what is the strategy for Microsoft? There's basically a couple different tenets to our strategy. If you go out and look in Azure right now, there's actually this thing called a dev test environment. The idea there is to be able to fail fast and cheap, is what we have on the slide here, but be able to try things out quickly. We have things in our quick start templates on GitHub, and we also have this dev test environment where you can basically say, hey, here's an Ubuntu VM. Here's a bunch of artifacts. Like, it'll list them out for you, and you can just say, I want to try this one. And it will go install those bits for you, and you can try it really quickly and say, yeah, I like this aspect of that. Maybe something else didn't work so well. Let me try another one. So in that case, you can try those really quickly. There's an idea of mixing and matching the best technologies. We'll talk through that in a slide that's coming up here around the middleware and how does that actually function with a blockchain. We've been talking about core blockchain here up to this point, but there's a lot of things to actually make that thing enterprise ready, and being able to mix some of these technologies around from a functionality standpoint makes a lot of sense. Also, being able to create and innovate by building solutions on top of the blockchain very quickly. The cloud is obviously a great tenant for that. We can spin these machines up in minutes as opposed to having to go provision something on bare metal. We can share our solutions worldwide. That's a huge thing for Microsoft, to be able to say, hey, we have a marketplace actually up here. Partners can monetize and sell their product up here, or they can just distribute it through our channel. But make it easy for someone, like a couple clicks, they can have a full network running there, per se. And that goes to the provisioning aspect of the one click, being able to spin these things up, iterate very quickly on them. So this slide's really important, especially on the rate side of it. If you look at the stack that we're talking about here, From a Microsoft perspective, we'll start actually at the bottom, the base platform, and that's where we have these different ledger technologies or blockchains that exist out there today. So if you go out and search for blockchain on Azure, you'll see a couple of them in there right now, like Emercoin and Strato and some of these other ones that are out there. They keep growing. So we're adding more and more of those to those, and those are the actual like base blockchains, like the ledger itself is running on there, the platform, you would say. So in that way, we can actually host that thing and run it in Azure very easily. So those are virtual machines. We set up networks. We can do all that kind of stuff in Azure. That's kind of our MO to run infrastructure up there very easy. But not, you know, there's some value to be set there, but there's also more value as you start to move up the stack. So if you looked at the middle layer, we actually are saying, okay, so now you have a blockchain. That's great. But how do you even use the thing? How are you going to integrate it with your enterprise? How are you going to work with your, how are you going to do key management? Okay, so like that doesn't happen automatically for you. The technology is there and it works great as you can talk to that blockchain, but how do we store our keys securely? How do we manage our identities that are in that system? The crypto services with cryptlets, some of the BI and the monitoring aspects around these blockchains. This is what we see as middle layer. So how do we, this is where we're focused of saying, let's bring the partner solutions as well as some stuff first party from our product group to say, how can we complement these systems and make them easier for enterprises to engage with and use and start to integrate? So you're gonna, there's a lot of focus on that right now. A lot of people are working on these middleware kind of tools to make it easy as well as secure for these enterprises to integrate with these systems. And then at the top layer is the industry solutions, or like you can think about like the app layer. So in this case, we have the different verticals that are feeding in there, and we also have, you know, first-party stuff from Microsoft like the Office products or the CRM tools, SAP, Salesforce, all these different, you have storage vendors like Box. These guys can all complement and work with a blockchain ecosystem. They're not going to be a blockchain all by themselves, but they may be the front end to a blockchain application. They may be the storage layer for a blockchain infrastructure. Excel could be feeding into maybe an analytics solution that's looking at transactions that happen on a blockchain. So this is very interesting to be able to say, how can we build this in such a way that makes it almost transparent to the people that are sitting out there, the end users that are using a blockchain, allow the middleware there so that the enterprise can maintain control over what the heck this thing is doing, and allow all the different solutions to kind of feed into the base platform here and run on top of the hyperscale cloud of Azure to be able to do that. This is really the key strategy for Microsoft around blockchain as a service and how we kind of see that playing out. And how are we doing that? I mean, we're doing a couple different things. One is we have a pretty tight feedback loop between the POCs that we're doing, the Microsoft engineering teams. So as we're out here working with them, I'm directly involved with them. There's a lot of people inside Microsoft who are working on these things in all the different verticals I mentioned before. And so when we're engaging with them and building the POCs and trying to proving out this technology, finding those gaps, that stuff's feeding directly back into how do we solve these problems? How do we approach some of these issues that we're seeing, or how do we scale these things better? So there's a very good feedback loop if you're engaged with us in that. You would see that we're very closely connected. We're driving partner innovation and scale by providing, you know, blockchain tools and solutions through our marketplaces. So this just makes it easy for people to find. The idea there is to make it as easy as possible for someone who says, you know, I mentioned, let me back up a couple slides. I mentioned on this slide when an enterprise comes in, they might want to say, okay, I want to use this back end and I want to use these middle tier components and this is what my app is. So they want to, it's almost like a little puzzle to them, or like Lego blocks, where they can say, I want to put this thing together in a way that makes sense for me. In this way, that's what Marketplace is about, being able to find those solutions, put them together, test them out quickly, be able to see which ones work best together and what's, if there's any gaps there, fill those gaps, and actually then deploy that thing. And we're able to do that through, you know, publishing virtual machines and all these different things that are out there in the Marketplace. And we also have the idea of being able to do like a SaaS type offering. So we could have a partner actually come in using Azure as a back end, but have a different front end on it for the user to actually engage with, and kind of a nice UI to get them engaged through the blockchain. Building enterprise-ready blockchain middleware, as I mentioned before, this is huge to the glue that's actually going to hold this stuff together. So just hitting on it again, the identity and certification or certificate services. Again, a tremendous amount of focus inside Microsoft from the identity team on what's happening here. From an encryption standpoint, how do we hold the keys? We have things like Azure Key Vault, which provide HSM, hardware management for the keys. Being able to leverage those technologies as well as what's happening out on the client side. The cryptlet services is obviously a huge focus for us. If you go out and look in for Project Bletchley on the internet, if you just go out and do a search for that, you'll see that what we're working on there, and we publish pretty regularly to what's happening as that thing evolves. The gateway services, obviously being able to have multiple blockchains talk to each other. These things might not be using the exact same consensus algorithm or backend per se. So how do we allow them to work together? That's a problem we need to solve. And in some cases, it's been solved. We see things like BTC Relay from the consensus guys they've built to go from Bitcoin to Ethereum worlds. But how do we take that to other solutions that are happening right now, the new blockchains? Data services, being able to provide the analytics and machine learning capabilities that's inherent in some of these huge cloud platforms, being able to use those and harness some of the data that we see in the blockchain. And then obviously the management and the DevOps side of this whole thing, how do we do that, that kind of stuff. So from a cloud perspective, this is a little bit of a marketing thing, but it just shows like kind of the breadth of what we're working with here inside Azure. We have the infrastructure components, the database aspects of it, so from a pure storage perspective, all the different app frameworks, and not just .NET. You know, obviously we have Java, PHP, Python, pretty much all of the main languages and frameworks that are being in use out there, we have it in Azure. And then you see BaaS, or Blockchain as a Service, is coming in here. It's just exploding. You know, we have a ton of vendors that are coming in here, partners, who want to work with our platform and integrate to it and make it be something that's available to their customers so that they can easily deploy their middleware or their backend and be able to spin up these blockchain solutions. We have about 5 minutes here, and I can show a real quick demo to kind of drive this home. But I also wanted to show you, I have some links out here that we'll put out there with the notes. And these things are really good if you're just getting started with this. Project Bletchley, I mentioned before, from our product group, this is directly from our engineering team, have been working on consortium networks. So basically, you're able to spin up an entire multi-node network and run that thing in Azure with a couple clicks of a button in a couple minutes. That's huge. I mean, because these consortium networks in the past are a bit of a animal to configure, right? You have to know some of the technicals involved in order to do it. In this one, you're essentially giving it a name and a location and saying, go build this for me. This is how big I want it. Block Apps, Strato is one that's huge in the marketplace. What the Strato guys have done, I'll take 1 second to say, because it's really important. They've built something that leverages the Ethereum technology, but also provides a REST API in front of it. Makes it super easy for people that are getting started in this, especially if you come from a web background, being able to code to this thing. If you're writing directly to a blockchain, you're probably doing JRPC or something of this nature. You're working with different clients to do that kind of stuff. That's the typical, you know, blockchain interaction. Strato is trying to break those walls down and say, hey, we can provide a nice REST API in front of that, and people can write to that REST API just the way they've done, you know, through all their web technology. Works great. Truffle. We have development frameworks there coming from the guys there, Tim Coulter, who's actually part of Consensus as well. He's building and working on a platform there with the community around saying, how do we make it easy to deploy with multiple smart contracts that can integrate together? So when you deploy one smart contract, it's easy, right? But when they get real-world applications where there's dependencies between these things, they are anchored in the blockchain, right? So if you make a change to some logic in your smart contract and it's in the middle and has three dependencies on it, you have to update those things then too. So you can do it manually, but it becomes unwieldy. Truffle really has a good framework to kind of solve that. So take a look at that link. Ethereum Studio has a full IDE in a browser. That's from the EtherCamp guys. That's out there in the marketplace right now. You can check it out. They have a site up there with full documentation about how to get started with that. Chaincore is a new one that just got released, which is can do both private chains and consortium chains on Azure. Nice interface, easy to get started with that one. You can check it out. And then we have integration into our dev tools with Visual Studio. So we have VS extensions as well as VS Code. You can go out and check those out in the Visual Studio Marketplace. Those allow you to start authoring contracts and help deploying them in some cases up to Azure, right? So being able to do that with a couple clicks, as opposed to you having to go in and do some sort of key management and this kind of stuff. When you're a developer, you're focused on, I want to build the actual like thing here. I want to build my application that I want to deploy. I don't want to sit here and learn about the technology of these keys because that's not important to me. So this is trying to kind of break down those barriers. But really quickly, I stood up one demo we have, and it's out on GitHub. You can go out and take a look at it at your leisure. You can actually build this yourself. But I wanted to kind of show you guys what this looks like. And this is essentially decentralized pizza. So, you know, it's kind of funny, but it actually drives home, like, three parties being involved in a transaction. So in this case, we have a couple different users of the system. We're going to have a maker here who's going to offer up pizzas for sale. Now, this is actually talking to a blockchain. This is talking to Strato behind the scenes, and you can see the little spinning thing here. It's actually making calls back to Strato right now to get the information. You can see his balance is 1,005 Ether right now. So he can say, okay, I want to offer up something new. And basically what we're going to do is build a smart contract here through this interface. And I only want to offer peppers on it because that's the people I want to be targeting, and I'm going to offer it up for $5. So when we say, okay, we're going to go ahead and submit, we're going to start mining a transaction. What's happening is we took this thing, we've signed it, and we just put it, we're putting it up on the blockchain right now behind the scenes. And if the demo gods are kind to me today, we'll see this go through quickly, and it did. So in this case, the pizza contract has been submitted. There's the actual address on the blockchain that it lives now. And so that thing is basically up there with no balance on it right now. It has, it's for $5, and the status is that we have everything set, and it has the toppings of peppers on it. So in this case, then somebody could come along as a buyer and say, I'm interested in buying a pizza. And I don't know if you noticed, actually, let's go back there so you can see that quickly. The one we just offered up that has peppers on it that's open here right now is this 21D, right? That's the start of the address. And so if we come in here as a buyer, we'll see the 21D is right here. We'll see it's open, so we can buy it, and it's $5, and I'll say, okay, I want to fund that thing. Now, I have to sign that transaction, so I'll put in my password for my keys. And again, this is going to make a call into the smart contract. See, my balance will go down eventually. Maybe I put in the wrong pass. Okay, there we go. So now it's mining the transaction. So it's signing that transaction, putting it up on the blockchain. You can see it's kind of grayed out here in the background, but you can see that my balance dropped. So now they know they've took the money from me, but it hasn't been given to that maker already because I didn't receive the pizza yet. So they basically have escrowed my money now. So they know for sure that I can pay for this thing, but they haven't given it to the guy yet. And what happens is we have a thing here called an oracle, which is the other actor in this system. And the oracle can basically simulate, in this way we're doing it manually, so I'm going to click a button and actually do it. But you could think about this abstractly. Think about in the future we'll have IoT devices, or maybe with the guy who actually delivers the pizza, when he delivers it, we know the address when he hits that GPS location, okay, he's delivered the pizza. And we can release the money to the maker at that point. We could have, in this case, like a survey system that says, we're really about the customer. So if the customer doesn't like our pizza, it's free. So in this case, somebody could come in and rate it when they were finished, whether it's the actual buyer or some system that they get a feedback from. In this case, they would say, tell us how satisfied you were with the pizza. Yeah, I'm happy with it. And you can see that the contract was paid to the pizza maker. And if we go out and look at the actual pizza maker, we should see his balance has increased as a result of that. I think my demo just crashed here a little bit. There we go. So in this case, you can see, we should see him go up. We didn't see it there yet. It's at 5, but it'll take a few minutes. The miner will run, and he'll actually get that dropped into his account. So just demonstrating that this thing can actually work. If you go look at the code behind the scenes of this thing, it's out there on GitHub. Just look for pizza demo. You'll see it out there for decentralized pizza. And that's really it. I see we do have something on Twitter, so I'll answer that. But with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up here. And I thank you guys for joining. It's been great. And provide your feedback. I mean, we still have the hashtag out there, and we'll have this published out there. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks.